This is Financial Standard, the definitive source of news, thought leadership and analysis for Australian wealth management professionals. Financial Standard, take the lead.
Welcome to the Financial Standard podcast. I'm Financial Standard journalist Andrew McKean, here with David Tuckwell, the Chief Investment Officer of ETF Shares, which is Australia's first new index ETF issuer in more than a decade. We're going to talk about the state of play in investment markets amidst the Israel-Iran conflict in the Middle East. Welcome, David.
Thanks a lot, Andy. Nice to be here.
LGT Crestone wrote a few weeks ago that we're in the fog of war with significant uncertainties with this conflict. What are sort of the key signposts investors should monitor to gauge whether this situation stabilizes or escalates?
I guess if they want a single data point, the usual go-to one would be VIX, which is measures of overall volatility in the market. It's been higher in the past, but it's still pretty up there by long-term standards. So that would be your stock answer. But elsewhere, if you're looking at particular asset prices that measure geopolitical tension, gold is usually the one that people often look at because it's the old safe haven trade.
And how should they prepare portfolios for either outcome?
I'd say that one thing that they could be doing at the moment is looking more in the opposite direction of what the market is doing. Because usually, the way you make good returns as a long-term investor is you do the whole Warren Buffett thing, right? You get greedy when other people get scared and you sort of trade into fear, so to speak. So as geopolitical risk has risen over the past few weeks, we've seen a lot of people flee to oil, a lot of people flee to gold, and we've seen some selling off in the equity market. To my mind, and maybe I'm just a mindless contrarian, the one way that investors can look to profit from this is go in the opposite direction. So rather than rushing into oil when it's looking like Iran may get attacked, or trading gold while everyone else is panicked, go the other way and maybe sell down gold, sell down oil, and move into equities instead.
I guess there's an idea of perhaps emergency de-risking portfolios. It could seem tempting given the conflict's escalation risks. So I'm imagining you would believe that's the wrong call. And, perhaps what are some better approaches right now? I guess you just touched on that a little bit just then.
Yeah. So when we're having conversations with advisors and investors, our view on portfolio construction is you've got to take a long-term view and you've got to go where and build on places that statistically maximize your chances of success. So the way of doing that is a pretty well-proven path at this stage. It's to lower your costs because all the evidence shows that the higher your cost base, the worse you do long-term. Keep it simple and stick with low-cost index funds that compound over the long-term. So we believe in having a clear strategy, and these are the conversations that we have. And don't get too unsettled by something going wrong in the market, because at the end of the day, there's always a reason to worry. Something is always going to be going wrong at some level or to some degree. Have a plan and stick with the plan. That's our approach in our view.
Sure. If we hone in on gold, though, specifically, which we were talking about earlier. So there was some research you wrote earlier, and that was from August 1971 to June 2025. Gold has grown at about 8.5% a year, compared with 7.8% a year for the S&P 500. What have been some of the most recent sort of boon factors, I suppose, for the asset class, which have really seen it accelerate in recent times? And do you think that's sustainable going forward as well?
You're exactly right to bring up the numbers. I think that's something that actually surprises people, just how well gold has done.
Definitely.
They know, I think, in the back of their mind that it's been a well-performing asset, but it's actually outperformed the S&P 500 on a price return basis at least. Since Richard Nixon ended the gold standard, it's done remarkably well. What's driven up the gold price so much recently, and you've got to remember, it's doubled since the start of 2023, so it's had a rapid run-up, is pretty much all the five stars that drive up the gold price aligning all at once perfectly together. So one star would be the US dollar. The US dollar tends to go the other way to gold, as the US dollar has weakened since Trump won the election. That supported gold. Treasury yields on US government debt, they've been coming down, which also tends to support the gold price because gold doesn't pay an income when government bonds don't either. Gold becomes more attractive. So they've come down too, or at least the futures curve suggests they will come down in the future, and the market prices are reflecting that. More geopolitical uncertainty, which we've also talked about. And the other two things, which I think people sometimes can miss that drive the gold price higher, are retail investors what they're doing, and retail investors have fallen in love with gold again. And we see that in ETF flows, gold ETF flows, launched to multi-year highs. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, has been central banks. Central banks never gave up gold when the gold standard ended. That's a myth that has persisted in the market for a long time. They continued to hold gold, and it still forms one of the most important pillars of their reserves. Central banks have bought gold in a major way since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and their buying has sort of acted like a corporate share buyback. So when you think of a company buying its own shares, it shrinks the amount of supply of its own stock available on the market, thereby driving the price up. It's a similar thing with central banks and gold. They buy it, they hold it, they don't sell it, and that then shrinks the supply on the market, helping to support prices. The question, I guess, for investors, including gold investors, is, okay, everything has gone perfectly right at the exact same time for gold over the past 2 years. Can this string of perfection persist going forward? Because ultimately, if any of these five drivers starts tapering off or falling off, you would imagine that the gold price begins to reverse or flatline a bit from this point in time. My view, and this is just my opinion, is now is a very good moment in time for investors to take profit. If you've owned gold or you've sat on gold for the past 2 years, you've done fantastically well. And you know, you'll never time the top perfectly. No one ever sells the exact top, right? But now is a good time to sort of take some profit, be modest, and don't let the dream of the perfect be the enemy of the very good. So that's hopefully an explanation of what's happening in gold and why we think now is a good time for investors to start taking some profit.
Definitely. And where would you be thinking would be a wise place to sort of park up that money if they were to sell down?
Yeah. So again, maybe I'm just too much of a contrarian, but I'm always looking to do or think of ways, different things than what the market's currently thinking. So it's been a very bad run, 2025 thus far, for the so-called Magnificent Seven stocks. They've underperformed the market as a whole, and people are starting to question US exceptionalism. In my opinion, there's no stocks really like them anywhere else in the world. They're the central engine on the AI boom, which we believe, and this is probably a separate discussion, that the market is radically underestimating the long-term repercussions of. I'd be looking at getting out of gold, which everyone in the market is sort of very in love with at the moment, and going back into the Mag 7 stocks simply because the long-term story there, I don't think anyone really questions. It's just a matter of timing, in my opinion. That's how I see it.
But I mean, if we are looking at US equities specifically, perhaps there's a perception that they might seem vulnerable with the valuations at, you know, historically very high levels, particularly the post-Liberation Day recovery. Do you still kind of take that position? I mean, is that more a long-term position what you're taking, or, you know, in the short to medium term, is there still some uncertainty there?
Yeah, so again, you're exactly right. I mean, the Liberation Day tariffs have got a lot of analysts worried about growth in the US market. Mm. The valuation concerns, I think people have always been somewhat worried about the valuations of the Magnificent Seven, just because they've always been, you know, at least if you look at it on a backward-looking basis, they've always been higher than market averages. But if you're looking for a number there that maybe addresses those valuation concerns, our preferred number is the PEG ratio, which looks at, yes, what the overall PE ratio is, but also has a look at growth or forecast earnings growth. And on the numbers we've seen, almost all the Magnificent Seven stocks, except for perhaps Tesla, have PEG ratios below the S&P 500's weighted average. So we think that's a pretty compelling data point suggesting that maybe the Mag 7 aren't as overvalued as people might think. But I do absolutely take your point about concerns about the domestic US economy in light of these tariffs.
If I turn to Australia as well, I mean, Australian investors typically have quite a strong home bias as well. It's a similar sort of story in many ways in that, you know, a lot of our larger stocks are relatively expensively priced. You know, is there any, you know, views that you have, I guess, on our local markets in terms of, I guess, forming an allocation there as well?
There's always going to be some kind of home bias for Australian investors simply because the tax incentives are just so strong. I think we're the only country in the world that has anything like the franking credits regime, which gives you a negative tax rate essentially on corporate dividends. So given that's just so important to retirees, and at the end of the day, people with most capital in this country are the baby boomer generation and those older than them, because they've spent their lives working and saving. Given you know, how important that income is from the bank's dividends and the franking credits they get on top of that to that demographic, I personally don't see a scenario where the home bias goes away or where those valuations on the CommBank and other leading ASX shares goes away. That's just my view. I think that's going to be more and more a structural feature of the Australian market as that part of our society moves towards retirement. They're going to inevitably be drawn to Australian shares because of the tax incentives they offer. That's just a structural feature that'll be permanent in my view.
I'm going to ask you as well to be sector specific as well, in light of the conflicts that are transpiring around the world at the moment. Is there any sectors such as defence, energy, possibly technology that could see maybe outsized impacts from the conflict, be that positive or negative, potential safe havens or areas of heightened risk?
Absolutely. So every NATO country, as far as I'm aware, bar one or two, has just obeyed Trump's pledge to increase defence spending to 5% of GDP by 2035. That does get a lot of analysts excited about the tech sector, and we have seen that with a lot of defence companies' shares rallying quite strongly over the past 6 months or so. Another way of looking at that, in my view, is to look at the industrial sector instead. The industrials sector is a bit of an unsexy, unloved part of the economy that doesn't get too much airtime. But if you look at which part of the economy the defence companies all come from, they're overwhelmingly industrial sector plays. And that is the pillar of the economy that stands to gain so much from Trump's increased infrastructure spending, from this new NATO pledge to ramp up defence spending. And because it doesn't tend to generate as much headlines as perhaps the tech sector does from time to time, it doesn't get the same sort of interest and stretched valuations from retail investor participation. So that's another area I'd be looking at as a sign of the times, the industrial sector.
Fantastic. I suppose, is there any final sort of takeaways you would have, you know, in terms of what sort of advice you would give an advisor or an investor, I guess, in light of the conflict in the Middle East at the moment?
In light of the conflict? Yeah, absolutely. My view is, again, it's just so important to keep in mind that old Warren Buffett quote. For investors, and Buffett famously said, what determines success is not so much characteristics of your intellect, how smart you are. What determines success is characteristics of behavior, and particularly how disciplined you are. Finance, it always has been an industry that rewards behavioral traits over intellectual ones. So, yes, it's awfully shocking what's happening in the Middle East right now, but, you know, something's always happening and something's always going to go wrong. Have a long-term plan, build one out with your advisor, stick to it. Don't let short-term noise get in the way of that. That would be my advice, as boring as it may sound. Sometimes the most boring and disciplinary lessons are the most important.
No, thank you so much for your time, David.
Thanks a lot. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for listening to this Financial Standard podcast. For more information, visit financialstandard.com.au. Please keep in mind that the information discussed in this podcast is general in nature and does not consider personal circumstances. Reliance should not be placed on any content without further independent financial research and advice.